Thanks again.
I've been speaking with Partnership for Safety and Justice, Talia Gad, and Babak Zovigari Azar. Listen to this and previous Prison Pipeline programs at kboo.fm/prisonpipeline. Like Prison Pipeline on Facebook. Thank you to our engineer, and thank you for listening. Listeners, I'm Karen James, a host of Prison Pipeline, asking you to donate to KBOO's Winter Drive. If you just listen to Prison Pipeline, thank you. Now show your support by going to kboo.fm and clicking on the donate button in the top right corner. On tonight's Prison Pipeline, we heard from Partnership for Safety and Justice, who is reforming public safety and the Oregon criminal legal system. You tuned in right now because KBOO reports on these grassroots organizations working for change right in your community. So please support KBOO, your community radio station. Go to kboo.fm and give. Don't let me be misunderstood.
You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
Thank you for tuning in to KBOO Community Radio during this special programming campaign, All Thrills, No Frills, Volume 2. This February and March, you will hear different marathons and series, all brought to you by our talented programmers, including specials like Women's History Month. If you'd like to help KBOO reach our $17,000 goal by March 25th, go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to the number 44321 right now. We thank you. And you're welcome.
Rise them up, KBOO 90.7. You don't know it's your girl, Tasha T.
Welcome to Let's Talk About Race, an intergenerational discussion about race with independent journalists from the Pacific Northwest. From Grassroots News Northwest, I'm your host and moderator, Lenita Duke.
Hi, I'm Althea Billings. I'm a journalist and radio producer in Portland, Oregon, and I'm Generation Z.
Greetings. I am Professor Johnson, political analyst and educator, and baby boomer from the Lone Star State, Texas.
I am Cecil Charles Prescott. I host a talk show in Portland, Oregon, and I am a baby boomer.
I'm Nia Gray, the faith reporter from Pennsylvania, and I'm Generation X.
I'm Michelle Melton, and I'm an associate producer and technology reporter in Georgia, and I'm a millennial.
Hello, my name is Mary Lee, and I live in Portland, Oregon, and I work for The Mill, the Multnomah Idea Lab.
Come on.
Let's talk about race. Let's talk about you and me. Let's talk about all the good things. Talk about things that make me. Let's talk about
race.
Let's talk about
race.
Talk about
race. Welcome to another edition of Let's Talk About Race. This show is a dangerous show. We're going to address a dangerous topic during these dangerous times. Let's Talk About Race is going to dip our toe into international waters as we discuss the current white-on-white crime between the country of Ukraine and their former partner, Russia. Russia wants Ukraine back. This is an international domestic violence situation. The partner becomes furious when the ex-partner wants to leave, or as in Ukraine's case, looking affectionately at NATO and the West. Here's an actuality from our Let's Talk About Race DV show with Mary Lee.
one of the most dangerous times in the relationship is when the woman tries to leave or expresses that they want to leave. And, you know, understanding the cycle of violence and that there is a cycle and that there are these dynamics, in addition to everything that my colleagues have said, in essence, at that moment in time, the violence that has been so effective for the abuser to be using against his victim has failed, because the evidence of an autonomy or a self-determination or an ability to say, nope, I actually am worth it, I actually can move, I actually shall move, is almost pushing it in the face of the abuser that your abuse has failed. Your attempt to control this person has failed to the extent that they are contemplating or struggling or trying or actually leaving you. And that is part of why I think it's a particularly dangerous time.
The ex-partner, Russia, has big guns, nuclear armaments, hence the title of this episode, 100 Seconds to Midnight.
In just a few days, Vladimir Putin has not just invaded Ukraine, he's seemingly threatened nuclear war on anyone trying to stop him.
President Putin has ordered Russia's strategic nuclear forces to be placed on high alert.
Could Putin really start a nuclear war? Is Putin threatening nuclear force?
When Vladimir Putin announced his invasion of Ukraine early on Thursday morning, he warned that nobody should get in his way or they would suffer grave consequences. And he didn't say what those were, but everyone understood that it was a reference to nuclear weapons. What he's done over the weekend is make that threat even more explicit by saying he's going to move his deterrence forces, which are the way that they describe their nuclear forces, onto higher readiness. And what that means is that the command and control system for Russian nuclear weapons in peacetime normally would not allow launch orders to go through. But now that it's on higher alert, those orders can go through. So the analogy I would use would be to say it's like disengaging the safety catch on a gun. It makes it easier to send orders through to those nuclear weapons.
What does Putin hope to achieve with threats of nuclear escalation?
What's important to say is that putting nuclear forces onto higher readiness isn't a preparation for using them. He's not about to launch missiles at the West. What the purpose is to say, don't get in my way as I do this invasion of Ukraine, because who knows where it'll end up? The risks are so high. He's manipulating the risk of this conflict to try and deter the West from getting involved. And of course, it is involved. It's been sending weapons, arms, anti-tank weapons, ammunition to Ukraine. And I think that one of Putin's objectives is to say, you're playing with fire. Stay out of my way, or who knows where it could all end up.
Putin has nuclear warheads. And I can't even believe I'm asking this question. Yet he's the one that brought it up. Putin brought this up. He might engage in a nuclear option, and then all bets are off. Do you think he will use nuclear weapons when he's doesn't have any more options? He has economic sanctions. His people cannot watch porn anymore. They can't watch Netflix. They can't go to McDonald's. They can't do an international financial transaction. The ruble is worth 5 cents. I mean, he's backed in a corner. Do you think he'll push that red button? Let's start with Althea.
In my view, it's entirely possible. Granted, I'm someone who was born after the end of the Cold War, so I haven't lived through the threat of nuclear war. I did think it was going to feel a little different than this. But given that Putin has been described as erratic, potentially some serious health conditions on his plate, and that he's been losing face internationally and in his own country since the invasion began, because it wasn't this quick coup that his people were expecting, it is entirely possible. And this is the entire reason that disarmament is so important, is that so that erratic people with an axe to grind, with something to prove, push up against the wall, do not have this disastrous option I think it emphasizes the need for disarmament. I think it's possible. It seems like an overreaction, but again, we don't fully understand what we're up against in the idea of trying to prevent nuclear war, nuclear fallout.
Today, the members of the Science and Security Board find the world to be no safer than it was last year at this time, and therefore have decided to set the doomsday clock at 100 seconds to midnight. The doomsday clock continues to hover dangerously, reminding us how much work is needed to ensure a safer and healthier planet. We must continue to push the hands of the clock away from midnight.
In the current environment, where we have neither arms race stability nor crisis stability, tensions over Ukraine loom ominously. And with China, efforts to craft a strategic stability are in their infancy. In climate change, rhetorical progress is not yet matched with swift actions. And in the sphere of biosecurity, trends point toward less rather than more cooperation to identify and manage or mitigate threats. A particularly invidious threat is the intentional undermining of the public's ability to sort out what's true from what's patently false by information warfare. This subverts our ability to arrive at consensus on the solutions needed to achieve positive change. We include at the end of our statement an illustrative list of positive actions that could make a meaningful difference. Although it's not often said, the Science and Security Board is largely optimistic about humankind's ability to use technology to mitigate existential threats, provided there is a will to work toward common objective.
Well, Cecil and Professor Johnson, we're baby boomers. And we grew up with a threat where you had to get under the table, like that was going to do something in the event of a nuclear war. Our parents, especially the generation above us.
Deedle-dum-dum, deedle-dum-dum, there was a turtle by the name of Bert, and Bert the turtle was very alert. When danger threatened him, he never got hurt. He knew just what to do. He'd duck and cover, duck and cover.
He did what we all must learn to do.
You and you
and you
and you. Duck and cover.
Be sure and remember what Bert the Turtle just did, friends, because every one of us must remember to do the same thing. That's what this film is all about. Duck and cover. This is an official civil defense film produced in cooperation with the Federal Civil Defense Administration and in consultation with the Safety Commission of the National Education Association.
What do you think, Cecil? Then we'll move to Professor Johnson. Will he or won't he?
That is the question that no one knows the answer. Since World War II, and since the time that the former Soviet Union had nuclear weapons, there has been something that has been called the doomsday clock, which is set each January, where scientists speculate about how close we are to the destruction of the world, hence the name, the doomsday clock. Currently, it is set 100 seconds to midnight. That's an extremely close and dangerous moment. It's the closest it has been in many, many years. I believe it was in 1991 or 93, right after the end of the Cold War, that the clock was moved to, I believe, 17 minutes before the hour. And I think we must realize there is a threat and that these nuclear weapons are a reality. And in the 1980s and before that, when the threat of war seemed so real, there was a mass movement to dismantle nuclear warheads. I hope it's not too late for a worldwide movement to reestablish itself, because we are, in so many ways, destroying the future for our children. If it's not climate change, it's the nuclear weapon. What a wonderful world we are leaving for future generations.
Thank you, Cecil. Professor Johnson, will he or won't he?
That's a tough question. I don't know how to get inside the head of Putin where I'm sitting. I heard a quote today by Alex Presha on ABC News, and he was quoting John McCain, and he said that John McCain said Russia is a gas station masquerading as a country. I thought about that because I think this is really about Putin trying to change that, resurrect Russia in a way as a world power. That objective makes me nervous, that yes, he could take drastic steps. The reporting today is his military is faltering a little bit. They're getting reports that some of the soldiers, because they are, what do you call it, conscripted soldiers, they aren't really understanding why they're there, and they're not on board with the reason they're there. They're looking at people that look like them, that could be their parents or be related to them. This military step he has taken has not turned out like he planned, and it has not advanced as quickly as he thought. And without a way out for someone who I think is very narcissistic, where he can save face, I think he could be driven to take some pretty drastic steps. I don't know what the way out is. He's gone so far, I'm not sure where the diplomatic solution lies for him.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Let's Talk About Race, an intergenerational journalistic roundtable focusing on the issue of race. From Grassroots News, I'm your host and moderator, Lenita Duke.
Hi, I'm Althea Billings. I'm a journalist and radio producer in Portland, Oregon, and I'm Generation Z.
Greetings. I am Professor Johnson, political analyst and educator, and baby boomer from the Lone Star State, Texas.
I am Cecil Charles Prescott. I host a talk show in Portland, Oregon, and I am a baby boomer.
I'm Nia Gray, the faith reporter from Pennsylvania, and I'm Generation X.
I'm Michelle Melton, and I'm an associate producer and technology reporter in Georgia, and I'm a millennial.
Hello, my name is Mary Lee, and I live in Portland, Oregon, and I work for The Mill, the Multnomah Idea Lab.
Come on.
Let's talk about race. Let's talk about you and me. Let's talk about all the good things and the bad things that make me. Let's talk about
race.
Let's talk about
race.
Talk about
race.
President Putin has put his nuclear deterrence forces on high alert.
I order the Minister of Defense and the Chief of General Staff to put deterrent forces of the Russian army on special combat standby duty.
That means the Kremlin's nuclear weapons operators will be primed and ready to attack at short notice if President Putin decides it's necessary. It's basically down to Putin whether or not to launch the nuclear weapons, and he has constant access to a briefcase called the Cheget, from which he can launch the weapons in response to a crisis.
Do you think he's crazy enough to instigate a nuclear conflict?
I'm not going to speculate on what he would or wouldn't do, but that's why we all keep our deterrence at a state of readiness in the West to make sure that we can deter.
The world's use of nuclear weapons is kept in check by a concept called mutually assured destruction. The idea is fairly simple and works on the assumption that the risk of retaliation from one nuclear power against another would be so devastating, it ensures two nuclear powers would never in reality attack one another. However, the theory doesn't hold for a nuclear state attacking a non-nuclear power. Globally, there are five states officially recognized as possessing nuclear weapons by the Non-Proliferation Treaty. That's an international treaty designed to prevent the spread of nuclear weapons. The five countries are also the permanent five members of the UN Security Council: China, France, Russia, the US, and the United Kingdom. In January 2022, they all pledged to prevent atomic weapons from spreading and to ensure a nuclear war is never fought. There's also a handful of countries that have nuclear weapons that aren't signed up to the treaty. These are believed to include India, Israel, Pakistan, and North Korea. But more than 90% of the world's nuclear warheads belong to Russia and the United States.
He does. It's been reported that Russia has a very large arsenal of battlefield nukes. So he certainly has the nuclear power, and also reported that he's ordered his country's nuclear forces to be put on a special regime of combat duty. So that has happened. You had asked us about hypocrisy when we were responding to that first question, and I think this is the ultimate example of hypocrisy, because Ukraine had one of the largest nuclear weapons stores back in the 1990s. The United States and Russia agreed with the Ukraine that if they gave up those weapons, they would not be attacked. And here we are.
This is the scariest show we have ever done. Truly alarming.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Let's Talk About Race, an intergenerational journalistic roundtable focusing on the issue of race. From Grassroot News, I'm your host and moderator, Lenita Duke.
Hi, I'm Althea Billings. I'm a journalist and radio producer in Portland, Oregon, and I'm Generation Z.
Greetings. I am Professor Johnson, political analyst and educator, and baby boomer from the Lone Star State, Texas.
I am Cecil Charles Prescott. I host a talk show in Portland, Oregon, and I am a baby boomer.
I'm Nia Gray, the faith reporter from Pennsylvania, and I'm Generation X.
I'm Michelle Melton, and I'm an associate producer and technology reporter in Georgia, and I'm a millennial.
Hello, my name is Mary Lee, and I live in Portland, Oregon, and I work for The Mill, the Multnomah Idea Lab.
Come on,
let's talk about race. Baby, let's talk about you and me. Let's talk about all of the things and the bad things that make me. Let's talk about
race.
Let's talk about
race.
Talk about
race. There is a double standard in how the media and the Western world looks at people displaced from the Ukraine or those displaced from Africa, the Middle East, or Central or South America.
Cecil, do you find the coverage of refugees from Ukrainian different from the coverage of those Afghanistan, Syrian, and parts of Africa?
Yes, I believe the media coverage of the crisis in the Ukraine is very different from the coverage we see of those who are fleeing war, poverty, climate crises from south of the border, from Asia, from the Middle East. Have we forgotten that there are thousands of people who are in cages on our border, who are fleeing war and poverty and the climate crisis? And we are doing very little to help and assist them. While at the same time, we see in the news how people are having bake sales and gathering goods to send to Europe to help those who are fleeing poverty and the climate crises and war in Ukraine. I think a public figure said something very well when he said that those who are fleeing war and poverty and the climate crisis are doing so not because of who they are, but because of things that are beyond their control. I hope that the compassion that we see extended to the victims of war in Europe extends to those who are victims of war throughout the world. I hope we will continue to have compassion for all victims of war, including those victims who are on our southern borders.
Professor Johnson?
I look at this in two parts. Part of it is the othering that is happening with the rhetoric. And then the second part is the treatment of asylum seekers. I would also agree that they are being treated differently in the rhetoric of the news coverage and also in incidences that are happening at the various points where they're trying to enter other countries. And looking at what Poland, Hungary, Slovakia, the Czech Republic, they're all members of the European Union, and they were all very hostile towards Syrian refugees. Poland's deputy prime minister actually had said that letting Syrians in would be dangerous and would completely change their culture and radically lower their level of safety in their country. And that's what he had to say in 2017. And now Poland is really seen as setting the bar for their acceptance of the Ukrainians who are seeking asylum. I just think those statements are a clear indication of how these groups are perceived differently. This othering happens, you know, has happened in other countries with Africans seeking asylum, Middle Easterners as well. It's a window for us to learn from, in a way, when you hear this rhetoric and how they're talking about the Ukrainians are civilized, as if to imply that other asylum seekers are not. And hopefully on this global media platform, it's being called out and they're beginning to see how they really are verbally treating people differently, and also the incidences that are happening in the border, particularly with students trying to get out. I've read several reports on students that have been held at the border for days and they're still not able to get across. We're in a crisis right now. All of those countries say they are looking at it and they are working to make sure there isn't disparate treatment.
Already we have heard stories of Nigerians, Indians, and Lebanese residents of Ukraine also fleeing the assaults, being pushed back from boarding trains to escape Kyiv, also getting stuck at borders. Incredibly concerning for individuals who do get to safety, worried about the additional barriers and the dangers faced by their friends and the people they know.
Althea.
It's inarguable to say that refugees fleeing Ukraine have been treated both differently materially and very differently in media coverage than the other refugee crises that you mentioned. A charitable interpretation might say that because they're fleeing a threat that U.S. and Western European countries themselves have feared in recent memory, that is part of what creates that identification that increases their sympathy. But seeing media immediately identify Ukrainian refugees as folks who had no other choice versus how they characterize Black and Brown refugees as greedy or opportunistic, as Professor Johnson and Reverend Cecil mentioned, there is racism and xenophobia in that. And the refugee crises that have confronted the European Union for the past 10 years or so are a clear and stark comparison to what we're looking at now. It's also worth noting that the US and European powers, who have much more control over international media, have enjoyed proxy wars for quite some time. So their immediate reaction is shocking, granted, but all of these are shocking. And the images and the portrayal of European countries, of the United States, is very different than the media portrayal that is perpetuated to countries in the global South, that when they get sustained media attention, it has to do with a crisis, a climate crisis, perhaps, like Cecil mentioned, or extreme poverty or a war that's going on. Those things become natural, become associated, and become stereotypical. I think what we ought to take away from this is this racism and xenophobia is coloring both how refugees are being treated and how they're being portrayed, but also that war is a cruel and unnatural thing wherever and whenever it happens, and it should always be condemned in that way.
Thank you, Althea.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Let's Talk About Race. Our topic is the international domestic violence situation going on right now. We are 100 seconds to midnight. From Grassroots News, I'm your host and moderator, Lenita Duke.
Hi, I'm Althea Billings. I'm a journalist and radio producer in Portland, Oregon, and I'm Generation Z.
Greetings. I am Professor Johnson, political analyst and educator, and baby boomer from the Lone Star State, Texas.
I am Cecil Charles Prescott. I host a talk show in Portland, Oregon, and I am a baby boomer.
I'm Nia Gray, the faith reporter from Pennsylvania, and I'm Generation X.
I'm Michelle Melton, and I'm an associate producer and technology reporter in Georgia, and I'm a millennial.
Hello, my name is Mary Lee, and I live in Portland, Oregon, and I work for The Mill, the Multnomah Idea Lab.
Come on,
let's talk about race. Let's talk about you and me. Let's talk about all the good things and the bad things that make me. Let's talk about
race.
Let's talk about
race.
Talk about
race. How can the United States talk about protecting democracy internationally when democracy is not being protected here in the United States? How can we talk about protecting democracy when voting rights are being rewritten and gerrymandering is placing power in the hands of those without a majority number of votes?
Let's move on to a more obvious question. The correlation between the threat of democracy that the United States is decrying in Ukraine, and yet right here in America, we have a plethora of threats to democracy, just looking at our voting laws and gerrymandering. Do you guys see any correlation, any hypocrisy between what's going on when the United States talks about democracy in Ukraine and deathly silent, or the inability to pass a Voting Rights Act just a couple months ago? Let's start with Althea.
Throughout history, there's always been this push and pull between the two, between democracy, between authoritarianism, right? No democracy can be fully safe from authoritarian tendencies, as we're seeing in the United States, and no authoritarian government can be fully safe from the promises of democracy. And since the end of the Cold War, we've seen these kind of concepts become less exact and, in my view, less powerful than they used to be, especially considering that the idea of spreading democracy was used failingly as an excuse for the U.S. creating proxy wars and the invasion of Iraq and Afghanistan, all these types of things. And I think there is some sense of fatigue. There's not as much credibility for the United States to be saying that the democracy is really what's being attacked. The democracy is really what we stand for, and that's why we are supportive of Ukraine, or that's why we're interested in the conflict there. The push and pull of that democracy and authoritarianism is not quite as credible between competing governments, but it does exist between a government and its people, right? But the world's conflict with Russia, with this extreme aggression and humanitarian crises that it's created, is partially economic. It has to do with spheres of influence. And it isn't such a cut and dry thing, because there are authoritarian allies of the US and of NATO that we tend to cooperate with regularly. Saudi Arabia comes to mind, that enjoy a close friendship with the US and protection from the US because of interests outside of democracy or authoritarianism. There's a number of interests and issues at play. It's never just one thing. Never are our full military engagements truly based on that the principle of democracy must be upheld here. There's always economic interests, oftentimes oil, resources, who controls what and what spheres of influence a world power or a waning world power like the United States wants to maintain.
See so then, Professor Johnson.
105 years ago, the President of the United States went before a joint session of Congress to seek a declaration of war against a European power in order that the world, quote, be made safe for democracy. That president, Woodrow Wilson, was a racist, imperialist, and someone who did the bidding of the powerful. When the United States entered the First World War, Woodrow Wilson and those in power found they were in difficult situations because they had to explain why they were seeking to make the world safe for democracy abroad when indigenous and black people were not welcome or treated fairly within the United States itself. That remains a constant tension with every world endeavor that the United States has participated in since that time. World War I, World War II, the Korean conflict, Vietnam, the wars in the Middle East, all of those were declared as war for the principles of democracy. And it is so difficult for us in the United States to admit that we continue to fail in living up to those high principles. So while we must continue to decry aggression wherever it is found, while we must continue to uphold the rights of people to live in their own land free from the threat of terror, we must also realize that there is need for us to continue to look at the work we need to do within our own borders. And that, yes, indeed, we must be willing to admit that we have failed the high calling of being and sign of democracy for the world.
Professor Johnson?
Looking at this question, both how we look at it in terms of America as a democracy and then looking globally, I see this battle that's happening with Russia as like a trifecta of bad things, three main bad things. Democracy, we're talking about how people are governed, and it's clearly an attack against democracy. There's another battle here that has to do with the world order of things, of wealth that has been stolen and power that has been taken. There is a element of that as well. The third thing, why I call it a trifecta, is because it is a battle of what would be our normative standards, like our values. We look at one side that values diversity and gay rights and religious freedom and freedom of choice and the right to vote. We see that as progression. The other side sees that as regression. And we have a group in this country that are rooting for Putin, admiring what he's done, and believing that he is protecting the way they want things to be. In fact, David Duke, I think he said that Russia may be the last real America, because they see this America as being white, and they embrace values that are very different from the values we are trying to advance and that we see as progress now. This is a battle about where those values get set. And Russia has come to represent those very conservative values. There's conservative Christian organizations that are also in support of Putin. We have our own politician that are singing his praises. Yes, democracy is being attacked, but so are our values, and so is the position of this sort of elite classist group on a global level. We've seen conservative movements in the United Kingdom, we've seen them in France, we've seen them in Italy, and in fact, that is the one thing that impressed me when I was in Italy 5 years ago, were all the signs that said no more immigrants. You know, it was just all across the city of Rome. I think they were having an election, and that was the platform.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Let's Talk About Race, an intergenerational journalistic roundtable focusing on the issue of race. From Grassroots News, I'm your host and moderator, Lanita Duke.
Hi, I'm Althea Billings. I'm a journalist and radio producer in Portland, Oregon, and I'm Generation Z.
Greetings. I am Professor Johnson, political analyst and educator, and baby boomer from the Lone Star State, Texas.
I am Cecil Charles Prescott. I host a talk show in Portland, Oregon, and I am a baby boomer.
I'm Nia Gray, the faith reporter from Pennsylvania, and I'm Generation X.
I'm Michelle Melton, and I'm an associate producer and technology reporter in Georgia, and I'm a millennial.
Hello, my name is Mary Lee, and I live in Portland, Oregon, and I work for The Mill, the Multnomah Idea Lab.
Come on,
let's talk about race. Baby, let's talk about you and me. Let's talk about all the good things and the bad things that make me. Let's talk about
race.
Let's talk about
race.
Talk about
race.
Sometimes listening to the news seems like one trauma dump after another. Therefore, at Let's Talk About Race, we've created a new segment entitled Hope is a Thing with Feathers.
What gives me hope is the recent nomination by President Joe Biden of Ketanji Brown Jackson, the first African-American woman nominated to the Supreme Court. As we're seeing freedom and liberty under attack abroad and also now internationally, it makes me very happy. Long time overdue to see our courts look like what America looks like today. So I'm very proud of her. My family is inspired and supportive to see an African-American woman serve our country at the highest level.
Thank you very much, Mr. President. I am truly humbled by the extraordinary honor of this nomination. And I am especially grateful for the care that you have taken in discharging your constitutional duty in service of our democracy with all that is going on in the world today. I also offer my sincerest thanks to you as well, Madam Vice President, for your invaluable role in this nomination process. I must begin these very brief remarks by thanking God for delivering me to this point in my professional journey. My life has been blessed beyond measure, and I do know that one can only come this far by faith. Among my many blessings, and indeed the very first, is the fact that I was born in this great country. The United States of America is the greatest beacon of hope and democracy the world has ever known. I was also blessed from my early days to have had a supportive and loving family. My mother and father, who have been married for 54 years, are at their home in Florida right now, and I know that they could not be more proud. It was my father who started me on this path when I was a child, as the president mentioned. My father made the fateful decision to transition from his job as a public high school history teacher and go to law school. Some of my earliest memories are of him sitting at the kitchen table, reading his law books. I watched him study, and he became my first professional role model. My mother, who was also a public high school teacher, provided invaluable support in those early days, working full-time to enable my father's career transition while also guiding and inspiring 4-year-old me. My only sibling, my brother Kitaj, came along half a decade later, and I'm so proud of all that he's accomplished. After graduating from Howard University, he became a police officer and a detective on some of the toughest streets in the inner city of Baltimore. After that, he enlisted in the Army, serving 2 tours of duty in the Middle East. I believe that he was following the example set by my uncles who are in law enforcement. You may have read that I have one uncle who got caught up in the drug trade and received a life sentence. That is true. But law enforcement also runs in my family. In addition to my brother, I had 2 uncles who served decades as police officers, one of whom became the police chief in my hometown of Miami, Florida. I am standing here today by the grace of God as testament to the love and support that I've received from my family. I have also been blessed with many dear friends, colleagues, mentors, law clerks. I could not possibly name all of the people to whom I owe great thanks. But I must mention specifically the 3 brilliant jurists for whom I had the privilege of serving as a law clerk at the outset of my legal career. U.S. District Judge Patty Saris in Massachusetts, U.S. Court of Appeals Judge Bruce Celia in Rhode Island, and last but certainly not least, Associate Justice Stephen Breyer of the Supreme Court of the United States. Justice Breyer, in particular, not only gave me the greatest job that any young lawyer could ever hope to have, but he also exemplified every day in every way that a Supreme Court justice can perform at the highest level of skill and integrity while also being guided by civility, grace, pragmatism, and generosity of spirit. Justice Breyer, the members of the Senate will decide if I fill your seat, but please know that I could never fill your shoes. To my dear family, those who are here with me now and those who are watching from home, I am forever indebted to you for your love and support. To my beloved husband, Patrick, thank you for being my rock today and every day for these past 26 years. I love you. To my daughters, Talia and Layla, you are the light of my life. Please know that whatever title I may hold or whatever job I may have, I will still be your mom. That will never change. There are so many other people I would love to be able to address and to thank, but time is short, so let me end by sharing an interesting coincidence that has actually meant a great deal to me over the years. As it happens, I share a birthday with the first Black woman ever to be appointed as a federal judge, the Honorable Constance Baker Motley. We were born exactly 49 years to the day apart. Today, I proudly stand on Judge Motley's shoulders, sharing not only her birthday, but also her steadfast and courageous commitment to equal justice under law. Judge Motley's life and career has been a true inspiration to me as I have pursued this professional path. And if I'm fortunate enough to be confirmed as the next Associate Justice of the Supreme Court of the United States, I can only hope that my life and career My love of this country and the Constitution, and my commitment to upholding the rule of law and the sacred principles upon which this great nation was founded, will inspire future generations of Americans. Thank you again, Mr. President, for this extraordinary honor.
Do you have any trepidations about Biden's ability to get it pushed through the Senate, to get her nomination pushed through the Senate?
Well, we've already seen Republicans who have vowed to, you know, make this difficult because they feel like this is an affirmative action sort of move, but she is extraordinarily qualified for this position. So I think that Joe Biden and the Democrats need to make sure that they are pressing and pushing this and giving her all the credit that's due and not, you know, fall victim to whatever smear campaign the GOP has planned.
Althea, what gives you hope in this very difficult news cycle?
It really is hard to find something that comes readily to mind, but I did see that a Colombian court ruled that the government must offer a non-binary option for gender markers on official ID documents, which is a great step forward for them in terms of LGBTQ inclusion and equality.
In Colombia, the state of Colombia, the country of Colombia, in what is that, South America?
In South America, yeah.
As opposed to what's going on in Florida.
A strong counterpoint, you might say.
Thank you. Cecil, what is your hope is a thing with feathers?
Like my colleagues, it is difficult to identify a thing that is hopeful other than the continued resistance of people who are able to say there ought to be another way. I don't have any particular news story to point out, but I am encouraged, I continue to be encouraged by young people in Florida in particular who are standing up against the Don't Say Gay bills. They are marching out of their schools. They are writing to the governor and their state legislators. And something that the governor probably thought was an easy sell is something he is finding difficult because Generation Z refused to play by that game. So that gives me hope these days.
From Pembroke Pines Charter High School in Broward to Mass Academy in Miami-Dade, hundreds of students today protested Florida's parental rights and education bill, dubbed by critics as Don't Say Gay, for its prohibition on classroom discussion about sexual orientation and gender identity for grades K through third.
It's just treating us LGBTQ youth and adults as well as a political pawn, because we all know that they don't care. And they're just trying to gain points for certain supporters.
It's been so inspiring to see young people taking to the streets and taking action. Andrea Mercado of Florida Rising.
We say gay! We say gay!
Spoke at this demonstration Wednesday outside the Miami office of Florida Senator Ileana Garcia.
Because she is taking votes that do not represent the values of families here in Miami-Dade County.
The Republican lawmaker facing growing backlash.
And your seat isn't safe.
Over her recent remarks. Bravo's Andy Cohen weighing in.
Senator Ileana Garcia, who sat on the Florida Senate floor.
Gay is not a permanent thing. LGBT is not a permanent thing.
Sweetie, with all due, it's permanent. Trust me.
In this video posted to Twitter saying he believes the legislation is solving a problem that doesn't exist.
There's not a mass conspiracy of kindergarten teachers who are plotting to teach children to be gay.
If you are just joining us, you're listening to Let's Talk About Race, an intergenerational journalistic roundtable focusing on the issue of race. From Grassroot News, I'm your host and moderator, Lanita Duke.
Hi, I'm Althea Billings. I'm a journalist and radio producer in Portland, Oregon, and I'm Generation Z.
Greetings. I am Professor Johnson, political analyst and educator, and baby boomer from the Lone Star State, Texas.
I am Cecil Charles Prescott. I host a talk show in Portland, Oregon, and I am a baby boomer.
I'm Nia Gray, the faith reporter from Pennsylvania, and I'm Generation X.
I'm Michelle Melton, and I'm an associate producer and technology reporter in Georgia, and I'm a millennial.
Hello, my name is Mary Lee, and I live in Portland, Oregon, and I work for The Mill, the Multnomah Idea Lab.
Come
on,
race.
Let's talk about
race.
Let's talk about all the good things that
you're
about. Things that
make
things. Let's talk about
race.
Let's talk about race.
Well, that's our show for today. Thank you so much for listening to Let's Talk About Race. I like to end the show by saying every day and in every way, we hope you agitate for social change. Thank you for listening.
For more information on Let's Talk About Race, visit us on social media. We're on Facebook at Let's Talk Race 1, or check us out on Instagram at LTAR Show or www.letstalkrace.net.
The following program has been produced by Grassroots News Northwest.
I love you, Kay.
Welcome to World Ocean Radio. I'm Peter Neal, director of the World Ocean Observatory. Policy in action is policy that works. And despite frustration over larger initiatives and critical progress, there are examples that have been funded and fostered through the United Nations structure, other governmental, public, and private agencies. To alleviate any litany of failure in these editions, perhaps it is useful to feature some successes as harbingers of what is possible and what will be further achieved in the future. The most ambitious of international policy goals for the ocean is the resolve to protect 30% of the global ocean by 2030. Consider that the ocean covers 70% of the planet's surface. According to the Marine Conservation Institute, some 7% of the world's ocean is covered by some form of marine protection. However, only 2.7% is covered by what the Institute described as fully or highly protected areas. Marine protected areas are typically defined and designated by a national government within its exclusive economic zone up to 200 miles offshore, a collective area that includes special marine habitats such as mangroves and salt marshes, wherein an enormous wealth of biodiversity is concentrated and vulnerable to coastwise development and other threats to vitality and viability. There are over 400 marine protected areas in the world in some 65 countries, in the United States, the Mediterranean, through the Pacific Ocean Islands, and Australia and New Zealand. Antarctica, by treaty, is a de facto marine protected area. Although designated, they remain constantly under threat, susceptible to pollution, illegal fishing, military incursions, nuclear testing, chemical waste disposal, mining, bottom trawling, and more. Their borders are invisible. There can be no protection against circulation and other transported threats, and their management and enforcement capacity are often so limited that some are called paper parks, in that they have no real surveillance or protection at all. But they are the beginning of a structure, an environmental and political demonstration of feasibility, and they lie at the heart of the 30 by 30 ocean protection movement and provide a sense of possibility and hope for more comprehensive ocean conservation. Other successes are less legislative but more socially successful through enabled conservation values to build capacity and invent and apply new conservation practice. For example, according to the Global Environment Facility, one of its most successful investments was the reversal of the hypoxic zone created in the Danube and Black Sea region, where fertilizer runoff, industrial and domestic waste had created a dead zone that destroyed aquatic life and collapsed local fish stocks with catastrophic social and financial losses. The GEF, the UN Development Program, and the World Bank invested over $350 million in policy guidance and incentivized alternatives and reforms, reducing pollutants, revising planning standards, applying new technology for water treatment and waste disposal, modifying or drafting legislation, uniting conflicted interests and regional authorities, rebuilding ecosystems, and revitalizing an oxygen-starved dead zone into a rehabilitated, value-restored natural area. It took 20 years. Marine protected areas and coastal transformation are obvious tools to accelerate the process, to meet the goal, to make the difference. They exemplify policy that works. There are others, and we have them in our policy portfolio, waiting. I was once given a replica of an axe found at Lance O'Meadows, the Viking settlement in Newfoundland, that dates to about 1030, 10 centuries ago. Those settlers survived by living with the land and on the sea. My axe is both fact, a potential for action, and an artifact shaped by a human hand. The Vikings did not poison their shelter. They left marks of hard but successful living in the earth and along shore. My axe, then, is a metaphorical, magical tool, but it is only as good as the woman or man who wields it with wisdom and purpose. If we have the tools, if we have the funds, if we have the will, we had best get quickly started. 2030 is only 7 years from now. Surely we need a plan. Rescue. R for renewal. E for environment. S for society. C for collaboration. U for understanding. And E for engagement. We will discuss these issues and more in future editions of World Ocean Radio.
To KBOO on Wednesday, March 8th, for a full 24 hours of International Women's Day special programming.